This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina's Medicaid program covers 1.7 million people at a cost of $14 billion a year. The program for low-income and disabled residents had a turbulent past. Last year, computer glitches created a long backlog of applications and payments for providers, and Medicaid has been a question mark in the budget, causing cost overruns for many, many years. But health officials say the system is improving enough that the state could reconsider expanding Medicaid to 500,000 people who don't have health insurance. And yesterday, a joint subcommittee in the legislature recommended creating an independent board to run Medicaid in order to cut costs and improve management. According to them, here to talk about the state of Medicaid and other public health issues in North Carolina is the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Aldana Vosh. Secretary Vosh, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Also with us is Dr. Robin Cummings. He's North Carolina's Medicaid director. Dr. Cummings, good to have you here as well.
Good to be here, Frank.
So I know it's pretty preliminary because this is a subcommittee, a joint subcommittee yesterday, but it was a subcommittee on Medicaid and health administration. And yesterday they decided that Medicaid should stay under the oversight of the Department of Health and Human Services, as I understand it, but should be governed by an independent board. Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, as you had mentioned, this is new information to all of us as of yesterday. I'm very happy that the subcommittee has weighed in on the fact that the Division of Medical Assistance, Medicaid, should remain inside of the Department of Health and Human Services. I have publicly on multiple occasions stressed the importance of that because we're quite intertwined and it's quite complicated. Medicaid and our different divisions, divisions of public health, of social service, of our IT department, of other parts of the Department of Health and Services work collaboratively. And it would have been very disruptive and destructive to the health delivery system, to our behavioral health component of the equation, if it should be taken apart. And so I'm very, very happy that the recommendation is to keep it inside of the department. It's the right thing for the state. It's the right decision for our citizens.
Medicaid has been in the spotlight for a long, long time under many administrations in the state of North Carolina. You have proposed an overhaul. What are some of the primary components that you see in reforming Medicaid in the state of North Carolina?
We have been had the ability to work with the governor and work for the benefit of the citizens of the state for the last 22 months. And the department itself, in which the Division of Medicaid is part of that, is quite large. We have 18,000 employees and almost a $20 billion budget. So the problems that were faced in the beginning were not only inside of the Division of Medical Assistance, but also inside of the entire Department of Health and Human Services. So the first thing was to really reorganize, restructure the department and the division. So in reference to the Division of Medical Assistance, we have been on the path for the last 22 months to figure out why it has been a problem for so many years, what are the chronic challenges that it faced, and to identify those. So that was the first part of the equation. That was followed by structuring a very firm expert leadership team, both inside of the Department of Health and Human Services and inside of the Division of Medical Assistance, / Dr. Cummings, who was kind enough to accept being appointed the director. So the first is reorganizing the division and the department.
Let me hold you right there, because I know I've asked you a very broad question, and we want to hear the elements of it. But you just said the first thing you had to look at is what was wrong.
Correct.
What did you find?
Traditionally, the way Medicaid itself has been functioning in the same organizational structure for the last 40 years. Now, my goodness, what $20 billion organization, HHS, or $14 billion organization, a Division of Medical Assistance, for 40 years could possibly function the same way? Everything changes, from regulations to needs to budgets to requirements to IT. I mean, look at this magnificent high-tech office you work in, the studio. Can you imagine it still working the way you did 40 years ago on radio? Well, that's how we work. We work in a structure that's 40 years old. So the first thing was to identify, my goodness, it obviously can be made more efficient, more predictable, more reliable, and use the tools available not only to state government but to outside industry and to our citizens to improve the value of the division as it serves its citizens.
Well, so much, Dr. Cummings, let me ask you, so much about medical cost and medical care delivery is part of a very, very big system that the state of North Carolina doesn't control and that its Medicaid program can't by itself influence. So where are the points of contact in the program itself that needed changing? What could be fixed in the state of North Carolina as you saw it?
Well, one of the areas that we identified immediately was simply the way it was organized within DMA, the organizational structure. So for many, many years, you had two silos, and I use that word intentionally, silos. You had a finance side and you had an operation program side. And many, many times the two sides were not communicating. And we were told that in the past budgets would be created for certain programs within Medicaid, and the people creating that budget did not even speak to the folks in that program to say, well, tell us what's going on. Tell us what happened last year. Tell us what legislation has been passed that we need to be aware of as we create your budget for next year. So very simply, we took those two silos and we broke them down and we identified component parts of Medicaid, much as you would any business that manages $14 billion and takes care of 1.7 million beneficiaries. And so now we have a very strong financial sector. We have a business information, business intelligence office. You know, in the future, everything with Medicaid is going to be driven by data, and we get lots of information. And how can we use that information to help us deliver care better to our beneficiaries and to give a more predictable budget to our legislators, which they deserve? And so we now have a business section. We have a section that will be involved with compliance and oversight of our contracts. We manage some very, very large contracts, and those contracts need to be managed in a very specific way. We have an operations and we have a clinical. So we took those two silos, broke them down into the important parts that we think will be necessary as Medicaid moves into the future. And we're already seeing some very, very positive benefits from what we've done.
We are talking about Medicaid reform in the state of North Carolina and taking a look at the Department of Health and Human Services today on the state of things. Secretary Aldana Vosh is with us, along with State Medicaid Director Dr. Robin Cummings. So accountability, of course, is going to be an important part in any program that uses state money, in the Medicaid program, certainly. And there is a debate now underway. The North Carolina Senate would like to see a kind of managed care operation, a managed care system. You've been looking at accountable care organizations. And tell us why you prefer the accountable care option, Dr. Vosh.
Well, when we speak about Medicaid reform, we are referring to the healthcare delivery system. And traditionally in North Carolina, we would have a fee-for-service model. So that means that whatever we would pay for what was done, whether it's the Band-Aid or the operation, or we would pay for a given service. What we wanted to do is create a delivery system that is based on not only different incentives, but different outcomes and different values. So what is the ultimate goal? The ultimate goal is to get a person healthier and create that vision of having a person healthier inside of a system that is sustainable for the long haul, that is predictable and somewhat predictable financially so that the General Assembly can do their job and set a budget, and yet have that system really be patient-focused. So we're what does the patient need at a given point in time, by who and where, who needs to provide it to get the patient healthier. So patient-focused. Then we're creating something that actually is provider-led. And why is that important? Because at the end of the day, it is the healthcare providers who do know what they are doing, who do know the best interest along with the patient to make proper decisions, leaving those decisions really in the examining room between the patient and, let's say, the doctor.
I'm going to stop you right there just so that we get a clear picture of what it is we're talking about and the distinction that's being made between the administration, between what you would prefer and what the Senate seems to be moving toward. The Accountable Care Organization, as you say, is a provider-led organization that would take a look at the care. They'd be given certain benchmarks, but essentially bill for service. And if they spent too much, if they went beyond that, there would be penalties. If they saved a little money, there would be cost incentives. The other model would be a managed care model in which each organization, kind of an insurance-led, the insurance company-led model, and that's your pot of money. And you need to spend it, and when you're out of money, you're out of money. Of course, then you've got insurance companies deciding who gets what gets paid and what doesn't. Those are the two models. You've taken a look at the prefer the accountable care model. As you say, providers are the ones who are making the decisions.
Yes, because ultimately during these last 22 months, we've traveled the state. I spent thousands of hours meeting with stakeholders, with doctors, with patients, associations, organizations to see what do we have in North Carolina actually that works and what do people on the ground think that they need or they could do or wish they had an opportunity to do. And with the input of all our stakeholders, we have decided to create a model, an ACO model that is North Carolina specific. And that is the major difference. North Carolina, we live in a free market economy. North Carolina is a right-to-work state. We have extremely smart, entrepreneurial, dynamic, creative folks in our state.
That's the perfect place to leave it for this break, and we'll come right back and follow up as our conversation with Eldonna Vosh and Robin Cummings continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking about Medicaid and other health issues in North Carolina with the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Eldonna Vosh, and the state's Medicaid Director, Dr. Robin Cummings. So we're talking about this this distinction between an affordable care organization, which would be kind of a practitioner-led or provider-led system where you'd be accountable for the money spent on Medicaid based on incentives, or an insurance company-led model, in which case you would have your pot of money and then be responsible, and then that would be what you'd have to spend on medical care. So you talked about predictability, Secretary Vosh, but what the Senate would say is it's far more predictable to come up with a budget and say, here's what we're spending on Medicaid in this state, and live with it, rather than wait until we're billed and then either punish or incentivize those providers at the end of the
Not exactly. In reference to the predictability, it is a true statement that it is in an MCO model, there's quicker predictability in reference to setting a budget, but that's short-term. The way I look at it, it's short-term thinking. If your goal is to get the patient healthier, you need several years out to reap those benefits. The only way you will have a stab at not skyrocketing the costs is if you have a healthy population. It takes time for you to lose weight to, and therefore your blood pressure to become under control and your cholesterol and your diabetes to become under control. It's a change of lifestyle. It's providing different incentives for the patient. It involves having the patient really change the way that they live and how they and take responsibility for their personal actions. That takes time.
And Dr. Cummings, you've really been in charge of something that would be like an accountable care organization in the state of North Carolina. They've been fairly effective, and some of them have won awards for their effectiveness. Describe how they work, how the one that you directed for some time worked, and why you think it's a good model.
Well, the ACO model is not a new model. In Medicare, it's been used quite extensively. Several hundred ACOs exist across the nation. And in North Carolina, we've got 18 or so ACOs that are up and running. And some of those are functioning at a very high level. In fact, we had four of our six programs which are participating in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Savings, Medicare Shared Savings Program, that were able to show positive, strong results in terms of their quality metrics. One of those ACOs actually shared in some savings with the federal government. So this is a model that's been used quite a bit in the Medicare world, and it's now shifting over to the Medicaid world. And several states have already gone down this path. And we can look at those states. We can study the positive things they've done. We can study the mistakes they've made. as we form the program here in North Carolina.
Does it actually shift? Because again, Secretary Vosh and I think others have certainly said that wellness is the outcomes really matter, and that certainly one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act was to improve outcomes and shift the incentives to do that. We'll wait and see if it turns out. But how does this actually do that? I mean, one way or another, the providers need to get paid, and preventive care is certainly a way to improve outcomes. But are you asking them to take bread out of their mouths if they're too successful? I mean, we don't want to downplay the compassion of our providers. But again, as a business model, does it work?
It does work. It does work. It gives the provider the opportunity to participate not only in the delivery of care, but also in the cost. And it's predicated on a couple of things. There actually is a bit of waste and abuse in our present system, as we all recognize. And so it gives the providers the opportunity to try to work that waste and abuse out of the system. It makes them more responsible for the care of that patient in terms of cost. So it also helps the provider focus on those individuals who are requiring quite a bit of care and costing the system. A generalization is that in any healthcare system, about 5% of the individuals spend 50% of the money. So if we want to save some of that money, let's focus on those 5%, not to deny them care, but to make sure they're getting the correct care at the correct time. And if we can do that, we're convinced, and it has been shown, that this model can save.
So money. Then does the ACO model incentivize that if we get better outcomes for chronic conditions?
It not only incentivizes, it offers an opportunity to be creative. And the healthcare professionals are smart enough to do that. A simple example, the typical story of an older woman alone living, showing up in the emergency room once a week, and why is she there with her asthma acting up? And yes, she's stabilized in the emergency room and sent out. And back again next week. Well, the way you break that cycle is you simply ask her, ma'am, why are you here? Why are you really here? Well, the answer is, I don't have air conditioning in my apartment, and you have better food than I have. Isn't it just easier to be able to provide the fan for her apartment and figure out how to have that paid for and provide, whether it's Wheels on Meals to come and deliver or a senior center to check up on her? All of that will keep her out of the emergency room.
But to do that, you have to give
exactly.
that practitioner time and not incentivize them to have only a 5-minute visit. They need a 15-minute visit to find out about air conditioning.
But it's, yes, the system in an ACO model, in the accountable care organization, allows multiple people in the team to work with this patient. So it's not just the physician. That team collaboration, focusing on the patient's needs, ultimately provides the environment that the patient gets healthier. We may not be able to treat her asthma any better than she was treated in the emergency room, but we certainly can follow up and we can make sure she's getting everything she needs not to get into the emergency room.
Now, I understand that you're getting ready to prepare proposals for the governor, one of which might include expansion of Medicaid. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you for that question. As you know, Governor McCrory has never closed the door on Medicaid expansion, even from the beginning. And it was just a matter when we came into the administration was new, we had to see what was available on the ground, and especially the department and the division. At this point, we have succeeded in stabilizing and putting the department and the division on a path of success. We're on this path. So at this point, we can devote more of our resources internally to face forward in reference to the possibility of Medicaid expansion. That decision is not made by myself or the Department of Health and Human Services. It is we are simply giving information presently to the governor on our options for that.
What's your recommendation?
We haven't presented it to the governor yet, so you will be the second.
Well, he's listening right now. He'll save you some time.
Right.
I'll just save you some time and tell him.
I'm sure he is. But saying that, what we want to create is an ability to have Medicaid expansion that is best for North Carolina. It has to be North Carolina specific. This is not a one size fits all. And what we are proposing are several options for the governor, and we're almost there, so really truly very soon. And with those options, we are hoping that the federal government will be flexible enough with us in order to allow us to be North Carolina specific. And recently, the federal government has been far more flexible with some of the states than it had traditionally been. So we're quite happy to see that. And we are looking forward to working with the federal government ultimately to create something that is beneficial to the citizens of our state.
Flexible how? What's in the program now that you think should change a little bit to allow for North Carolina's specific needs?
Well, what happens is the states ask the federal government for something called a waiver in order to do something different than we have right now. And so we would like to have opportunities to perhaps focus on trying to get the patients healthier, perhaps to have some kind of the patients to have some form of responsibility for simple things, showing up for your appointments, taking your medicine, some form of engagement of the citizens inside of their ultimate health in some sort of a way. We'd like to have an opportunity to see if we can't coordinate health and some other opportunities for our patients, because a lot of our patients don't have the proper opportunities for work, don't have the proper opportunities for health, so somehow how to coordinate that. So there's a lot of different models that the different states are entertaining of to go think outside of the box.
Let me ask you
for
this,
the future, facing forward towards the future.
Well, I want to ask you this though, because we talked about not expanding Medicaid initially. We can quibble over the numbers, but somewhere around 500,000 people without medical care now. From the time we could have put them on the health rolls. So even if it's expanded, it's going to be a while. That's 500,000 people. Take the point that maybe the program was in disarray and you needed to get control, but those people needed medical care. Many of them are among that 5%. Things are going to be more out of control. It'll be more expensive to treat them the longer they stay outside the system. Wouldn't it have been wiser to expand Medicaid and do all of the analysis that you did while those people were getting treatment?
Well, having a person have two points. Right now we do, of course, do provide for citizens that do not have insurance, whether it's in the emergency room or inside of our public health departments or inside of our free clinics, inside of our federally qualified health care centers. There's an entire network. North Carolina is quite plentiful with that compared to other states. So we're quite
not as robust as if they had been covered under Medicaid. Or perhaps more expensive.
Differently. Right. But that's one issue. Just to remember that it's not that a person does not have an ability to get medical care. So that's one thought. But the other thought is giving a person an insurance card / a Medicaid card does not make them healthier. So in order to, first of all, give them that insurance card, our state has to be able to accommodate that. In order to accommodate that, you enter the system in the county at the social service department. That's where you had mentioned there was tremendous backlog. The backlog at the county's Department of Social Services with Medicaid was due to the Affordable Care Act. We had over 100,000 applications, folks, come into our county departments of social services due to the Affordable Care Act. We are not done yet after all these months, even in the backlog. We have worked it down to under 11,000 at this point, or around 11,000. So it took us all those months just to accommodate the extra 100,000 applications that came in from the Affordable Care Act. So it, in theory, I understand what you said, but in reality of the physical aspect, a card doesn't make you healthier, and you have to get the card. And so there's an entire process, and that's what we were building over all these months inside of the department and the division, the foundation in our state to be able to move to the next level and face forward for the future, both in the counties and at the state level.
Well, then let's take another look at that backlog. And again, as you say, you've handled some of it. But, I mean, does that mean that some of your confidence that the system has been brought under control, that you're operating in the black now, how much of that is just because there's still a backlog out there? What happens when that catches up?
Absolutely not. In order to get through a backlog, you had to create an entire system, not only here in Raleigh, but for the entire state and inside of the departments, working collaboratively with those departments, with the county commissioners, with the county managers. So an entire system was built, not only the IT structure, but the business model had to be created for the state. So all of that is on its path. As I had mentioned, we are on a path of success.
So, Dr. Cummings, are you confident that DHHS could handle an expansion of Medicaid at this point?
I think we're better capable of doing that today than we were 22 months ago. You know, and when you talk about the backlog, we're monitoring that very carefully. We're in constant communication with our hospitals, with our provider groups, and we're saying, if you know of situations out there where there is a backlog, let us know. Make us aware of it. And we are not hearing it. I know there was one statistic that we quote in terms of hardships. We made it possible for our providers to come to us and say, hey, I'm really experiencing difficulty here at this point in time, and so I need to apply for a hardship. And at one point, I think we had 50-some or so on the list. Today, we have zero on the list in terms of folks who have applied for hardship payments.
So at every level, whether it's the payment system through our, we had to implement the first multi-payer system really in the country, and we succeeded. North Carolinians should be very happy with that. We also were one of the very few states that were able, when the ACA it took effect, we were one of the only states that were able to intercept information with the RIT systems from the federal government. Granted, the federal government wasn't ready, it turned out, but we were ready as North Carolina. So we have unfolded massive changes inside of the state under our leadership that have faced us forward, both in payment IT systems, both in IT systems inside of the Departments of Social Service, our other IT system, both in the business organizational structure. So our improvements and the path that we are on now is a path of success facing forward for the future for whatever is in front of us.
Talking to DHHS Secretary Aldana Vosh today on the state of things. Also with us, Robin Cummings, who is the state Medicaid director. We've been talking about Medicaid, but we should really talk for a moment at least about state policies when it comes to Ebola. I guess what is the likelihood that it's going to spread to North Carolina, Dr. Vosh?
Well, thank you for that question. It is a very important question in the topic of Ebola. The entire world, our nation and our state, of course, is preparing for that possibility. At this point in time in the world, we have over 10,000 cases that are diagnosed for Ebola. In the United States, we know we have three documented in Texas, one in New York, and we have none in North Carolina.
Let me ask you this. I know health officials in Mecklenburg County are monitoring two people who just returned from West Africa. They're believed to be at low risk of Ebola exposure. What are the guidelines for health officials in North Carolina in cases like those?
Well, thank you very much. We work collaboratively with the CDC, with our federal partners, in reference to guidelines. But in North, and they change as the need unfolds, and they change quite quickly. Last night was another change in the CDC requirements. But we in North Carolina have been working since July to prepare our state for the possibility of anyone walking into any healthcare community and asking for help with that. We work very closely with our hospitals, with EMS, with our public safety, with emergency management. We work collaboratively, but actually we have many teams that do that. Our presently what we do is we follow the requirements, the suggestions of the CDC in reference to as people come to us, so that we diagnose them quickly and then we act very quickly to mitigate any possibility of further spread and, of course, treat the patient.
And I know New York and New Jersey, certainly they came under fire there, governors there from the federal government about their strict quarantine policies. What would prompt a quarantine in North Carolina?
Well, we are fortunate in North Carolina. After a few years ago, we had the SARS outbreak and other outbreaks. We have legislative permission or the law is structured in such a way where we have the authority to quarantine people as needed. And the quarantine is a spectrum What does that really mean? But we have the legal authority at each time necessary to ensure that we are not only taking care of the patient, but mitigating the ability for a disease to spread and protect the public.
Is there a fairly strict rubric, though, a kind of algorithm?
Yes.
If this symptom, then that,
yes.
And then you're down
yes.
a different...
Yes.
In terms of Mecklenburg County now, I understand that, you know, the people are sort of free to come and go. They're being monitored very closely. They're not being quarantined. Is your understanding that they're following those protocols?
Yes. Our protocols, it's very patient-specific. but roughly, the guidelines from yesterday, and we are kind of in that same path in the state of North Carolina, and this may get too technical. But when we speak about Ebola, remember, it is a disease that is not contagious to another person unless you have symptoms. And again,
if I have it and I'm symptomatic, then I can
correct.
Pass it on to you.
Correct.
If I don't have symptoms, I can't
correct.
Pass it on to you.
And it is critical to remember that. Mm. So we have all sorts of the rubric, as you had mentioned, that if a person has no symptoms and has absolutely no risk whatsoever, no identity. They didn't travel to South Africa. They didn't take care of patients. They weren't in the area. And there's nothing you do. There's no action you take because you can't catch it just by seeing someone in the street.
Someone who's just returned
that.
From West Africa. Well, I want to thank you both for your time. Dr. Aldana Vosh is the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Robin Cummings is the State Medicaid Director. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
We're going to get a visit from Radiolab, co-host on The State of Things, in just a moment. Stay with us.